Okay. Next case for oral argument is James Hansen, appellant, versus Terry and Susan Brown, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Brad Gordon, an attorney from Spearfish. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Dylan Wild, an attorney also from Spearfish. Mr. Gordon, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Chief Justice Gilbertson, Associate Justices of the South Dakota Supreme Court, good morning. This appeal is from the trial court's determination, as you know, that my client, Mr. Hansen, is liable in tort to Terry and Susan Brown for slander of title and tortious interference with the sale of their real estate in 2006. The circuit court so held because Mr. Hansen recorded with the Meade County Register of Deeds a letter he wrote and sent to the Browns previously, declaring that he was rescinding the party's well agreement. The first consideration I would urge the court to bear in mind when reviewing this matter is that James Hansen is not a stranger to the real estate transaction between appellees Browns and their buyers, Joe and Paula Ford. The Browns' rights under the well agreement ran with the land to be sold, and those rights are binding on all successors. And in that regard, it's important to consider that Mr. Hansen had a legitimate economic interest to protect regarding the well in question. It's also important to note, Your Honors, that the rescission letter Mr. Hansen sent to the Browns on May 19th of 2006 was given by the Browns to their buyers, the Fords, before the Fords signed an agreement to purchase the Browns' real estate. In fact, the Fords took the rescission letter to a lawyer who advised them that it was valid and ran with the land, and so did the Browns before the letter was recorded. We believe that is significant. Both lawyers rebuked Mr. Hansen, and he subsequently recorded the letter with the Meade County Register of Deeds. When the Browns and the Fords met to close on the sale, the Fords refused, apparently on the advice of their attorney. The Fords testified that their mortgage company balked on the loan, but what remains unclear is how and when Mr. Hansen's May 19, 2006 rescission letter was communicated to this lender. This has never been demonstrated definitively in the record.
But wait a minute. If you file something in the Register of the Deeds, that's notice to the world.
That is true, Your Honor, but you must bear in mind that this letter was provided to the Browns, the appellees, and their buyers, the Fords, before they ever entered into a purchase agreement.
But wasn't the problem at the title company door? When the title company balked at insuring the title?
That's correct, but the question is why did they balk, and when were they notified that this well was an issue? Were they notified by the Browns or the buyers upon their receipt of Hansen's private letter, or was it due to the publication and recordation with the Meade County Register of Deeds? Because I've reviewed the cold record a number of times, and it remains unclear. And the reason it remains unclear is because Mr. Rowe, the head of Meade County Title, said, well, we'd already entered our title order by the time we learned of this recordation. Okay? And he, in fact, said, I learned of this recordation from counsel for appellees Browns. When he learned of the recordation from counsel for appellees Browns is also questionable because it's not clear from the record and there's no date testified to. So once again, the question is, when did the title company and the lender learn of Mr. Hansen's rescission letter, which was sent privately on May 19, 2006, and recorded thereafter with the Meade County Register of Deeds. It hasn't been definitively demonstrated in the record.
What difference does it make?
Because causation is an element of slander of title. And appellees have urged and complained to the trial court that the recordation of this letter with the Meade County Register of Deeds is what caused their damage.
Wasn't that found by Judge Eckridge in these findings of
fact? He did.
So you're saying that you're urging us to find that Judge Eckridge was clearly erroneous.
I'm asking the court to consider the appropriate standard of review with regard to slander of title, and I believe the malice part of it is fully reviewable. That's what the case law tells me. And I'm asking the court to consider whether there is indeed a demonstrated causal connection between the recordation of this May 19, 2006 letter with the Meade County Register of Deeds and the refusal of the buyers to close on the sale.
I didn't see there was any dispute about the fact that the bank would not do the mortgage.
Well, we certainly objected to the hearsay, Your Honor.
Well,
and we objected numerous times strenuously, but it was let in. But once again, I raised the matter because it appears to me to be a question of the causal connection between the recordation and the refusal to close on the sale. Bearing in mind, once again, that the buyers, the Fords, were given a copy of this letter by the sellers, the Browns, before they signed the purchase agreement and before that letter was recorded with the Register of Deeds.
Does it make a difference if the title company obtains actual knowledge of the letter, whether that actual knowledge comes from the Register of Deeds office or they get a copy of it from a third party, like the Fords?
I think in this
case,
way,
aren't you slandering the title?
Well, are you slandering the title by giving a private letter expressing that you have good cause to rescind? And that letter, before a purchase agreement is executed, is given to the prospective buyer. I would urge the court that it is an important consideration and a problem.
You mean there's some heightened significance to the fact the letter went across a Register of Deeds office than if it went directly to the title company?
No, and I may be confusing the court, and I apologize, but I think you must bear in mind that the letter was provided privately to both the appellees and their buyers, and in the face of that, they executed the purchase agreement in any event. Now, once again, when you review the testimony of the owner of the title company, Mr. Dan Rowe, he says, well, we'd already engaged our title commitment order before I learned about this. And I learned about it from counsel for Appellees Browns. So again, it seems to me that there's a question as to whether there is a sufficient causal connection between recordation and slander. And I think that's one of the key elements. Anyway, I'll move on. What the lender was told and when is what I'm asking the court to consider. By whom? Bearing in mind that there was prior knowledge of the buyer that rescission was an issue. Indeed, two lawyers were contacted. They rebuked Mr. Hansen and said, this is a good, valid, well agreement. It runs with the land, and we're not interested in dealing with you, which is what he invited them to do in the letter. He said, if you want to resolve this, contact me, and let's sit down and meet and resolve it. And it's not insignificant that ultimately Mr. Hansen did strike a well agreement with the Fords at some point in time, but it wasn't soon enough.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's no dispute. The parties showed up at the closing, and and the closing did not take place.
That's happened.
Because of this letter.
That's correct.
Well, so I don't get it. I mean, that's causation.
Well, the pleadings of the plaintiff state that it was the recordation of the letter that was the causation, not the private letter given to the Browns and their purchasers, the Fords. The pleadings specifically state that Browns were slandered. Their title was slandered because Hansen recorded with the Meade County Register of Deeds that letter. And that, once again, from my review of the record, remains unclear. Further, as the court well knows, to sustain a slander of title claim, the alleged false statement must be material. Now, Judge Eckrich expressed that there were a number of statements contained within this letter that were not true. The question is were they material? What was material about that letter was the fact that Hansen was rescinding.
The title company thought it was material. They wouldn't go ahead with the closing.
Right. Once again, Judge, I'm not making myself clear. There are statements within the rescission letter. For example, you didn't pay the electric bill. That's one of my bases for rescinding. But those, I would urge the court, are not material. What is material is the fact of rescission itself. The fact that Mr. Hansen said, I am rescinding this well agreement. That was the penultimate issue with the lender. Is that if you don't have water, we're not going to lend you money. Okay. Bear in mind, he never did shut the water off, but that's not material either. The point being is that the rescission itself was the material fact or the material issue expressed in that letter. Now, the question is was that false? Well, no, it wasn't false. He was saying, this is what I'm doing.
Wait a second. We said in the prior case that it's not true. We said you couldn't rescind it.
You said it was a case of first impression.
That's right, but...
Right, which he didn't know at the time he did.
Right, but this trial court found that his reasons for termination were a pretext. And I don't see you challenging those findings of fact. He didn't intend to enforce any legal right here. That's what the trial court found.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with the trial court. As I expressed a moment ago, he had a legitimate economic interest to protect, notwithstanding the court's...
He may have had an economic interest, but the trial court said he did it for different reasons.
Solely for different reasons? I don't know that is accurate.
Well, that's what the trial court found.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you're going to have to show that under the standard of review that that's not correct. Now, what do you have to show that the trial court's findings aren't correct?
Well, we have the testimony of Mr. Hansen that...
So you're saying that you want us to find that the trial court was clearly erroneous on its factual findings?
In part, Your Honor.
Okay, which however, ones?
Go ahead.
Which ones and based on what?
Well, Your Honor, where I was going on this is one of the elements is malice. My review of the case law is that malice is fully reviewable with regard to slander of title. Now, if in fact it was determined that Mr. Hansen had a legitimate reason to rescind this agreement or a reasonably colorable basis, if you will, then I would urge that notwithstanding any suggestion of pretext, he had a basis to state his rescission in the letter, and that at the time he did that, in the absence of a ruling from the South Dakota Supreme Court on the easement statute implicated, that was not unreasonable.
Well, in the transcript, I believe it asked, okay, under what authority did you feel you could rescind it? He said, under my own authority, or or something to that effect, did he not? So did he have any basis for his decision?
Well, we have...
Other than his own feeling.
We have the uncontroverted fact that the Browns were using the water beyond the scope of the easement for a number of years. We have...
Does that give you a basis for rescission?
That's the question. And, of course, rescission is a contractual term, not a tort term.
This is an agreement that on its face is filed. The well agreement is on its face. It's filed and runs with the land.
Correct.
So your client determined on his own that he could unilaterally rescind the agreement.
He sent a letter expressing his rescission. However, he never turned the water off. He never took steps to actually enforce the rescission. And in fact, it was put in the hands of the South Dakota Supreme Court on the first appeal in this case.
So if I understand what you're saying is that simply saying that our contract is rescinded can't be a false statement in itself because it's merely a legal opinion, and it was a legal opinion that had never been we hadn't decided the case. No trial court had decided it. That's what you're saying?
That's what
so
I'm
that
arguing,
can't be
John.
The false statement
correct
itself. Well, I tend to agree with you, but I think the trial court also agreed with you because the trial judge said Hansen's legal argument was honestly debatable. I don't think he's saying that merely because he said the contract's rescinded. Without anything else, that it was false. I think he went on to say the false part was the declaration about the not paying the electrical bill and the stuff about people camping there earlier. And that's what made this false. Am I wrong?
I didn't read it that way, Your Honor, or at least I don't read the elements of slander of title or injurious falsehood, whatever you call it, to comport with that expression. If, in fact, his statement that I'm rescinding is not a false statement, then one of the key elements is missing, whether he has a pretext or not, because the pretext is the malice part of it. And if you remember from the Gregory's v. Hahn case, the court said explicitly in that mechanics lien filing that you have to show falsity and malice, not falsity or in the disjunctive. You have to say, well, you got to show that what you said was false and you also did it maliciously. Now, deferring to Judge Eckeridge, if in fact the pretext that he found constitutes malice, you still have the separate fact that his expression that he was rescinding, which is the material expression of that letter, is not false. And it wasn't false at the time because the South Dakota Supreme Court said, you know, whether you can extinguish an easement under these circumstances is a case of first impression for us. And while the court ruled that an injunction would suffice, so extinguishment wasn't in order, I don't think it made his expression of rescission unreasonable at the time it was made.
Well, okay, but there's still the statements about him not paying the electrical bill, and it came to my attention that you're having campers on there when apparently the trial court found that your client knew there were campers there for years. His brother-in-law had built a shower house for them. So aren't those false statements? And aren't they material?
Well, I would suggest that the electrical was not material. I view materiality in terms of what was the reason that the parties did not close the sale. And they didn't close the sale because, one, the Browns didn't pay their electrical bill, and they didn't close the sale because the Browns had campers using the water beyond the scope of the easement. They didn't close the sale because Hansen said, I'm rescinding it. So that was the penultimate statement that was urged in the pleadings of the appellees to be the false statement.
Did he say he's rescinding it because of the electrical bill and because of the camper?
Well, no. Again, I'm viewing the materiality of those quote-unquote false statements from the perspective of the parties that refused to close. And they didn't refuse to close because Hansen said, you're not paying your electrical bill and you're having campers on there using water. They didn't close because he expressed that he was rescinding the well agreement.
Your time has expired, Mr. Gordon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Well, do you have 20 minutes?
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Dylan Wild, and I'm here representing the appellees, Terry and Susan Brown. The question that seems to be talked about most here is what here is false. If you look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 8, which is a document that James Hansen Cosby filed with the Meade County Register of Deeds, specifically states in the first sentence of that last paragraph, therefore, because of your broken promises and your deliberate and flagrant breaches of the well agreement, I have terminated the June 14, 2000 agreement in all respects. Now, if you look at the trial court's findings of fact, number 41, you'll see Hansen's, the trial court found, after a day and a half trial where he observed all the evidence, heard all the testimony, weighed the credibility of the witnesses that were providing that testimony, the Honorable Judge Eckrich found Hansen's filing was malicious. He knew the Browns had rejected his daughter's offer on the property. He knew the electric bill issue and camping issue were illusory, false, and pretextual. He now knew the Browns had defied his veiled attempts to reacquire a measure of family control over the Brown property. He knew the Browns now had a prospective buyer. He knew that the filing, his pretextual claim with the Register of Deeds that he would likely sabotage the Brown sale of the Fords and his sabotage succeeded.
All right, well, maybe we're arguing about angels on the head of a pen, but, you know, the argument that's in the briefs is that simply because he said the contract's terminated, that's a false statement because we later said that it's a false, that it was a, the con, it wasn't terminated. But that doesn't make it false in itself just because he declares it terminated, does it?
I mean, I think it's a little bit broader than that. His false statement is he terminated this because
Right, of course. But I mean but solely because he's saying that this court has said you can't do this, that now makes you go back to say, well, now that's a false statement, isn't accurate. It has to be because his reasons that he gave in the letter for saying that the contract's terminated, that's the false part.
I think it's a combination of not only the fact that he could not lawfully rescind this agreement, which in fact makes that statement false, but also the reasons that he is providing for his claim that he can rescind this agreement.
But if we say, okay, 1, 2, 3, the statement about the electricity, the statement about the campers, and the statement about termination, they're all three of those things are false. Are we putting ourselves in a position of saying that any time someone makes a claim against title that proves to be unsuccessful in court later, that they automatically regenerate a slander of title action simply because they made a claim that they lose?
No, I don't think so in this case. This case, the facts are, I think, distinguishable in that he knew that these statements were false. He knew that he wasn't terminating this thing because they did not pay what he believed to be their proportionate share of the electrical bill. He knew that they were not paying this because
those are the false statements. The false statements are the electrical bill and the camping. But what I'm asking you is, can we separate out the pure fact that he had a legal opinion about I have a right to terminate this contract? That can't be in itself false, can it? It's a basis for saying he's slandered title. I understand what you're saying, that it builds to that, but to say that alone.
To say that alone, I think in this case, yes, because he cannot rescind the Commonwealth and Road Easement Agreement just on his own volition. The court made that clear. You know, I guess what
does your case stand on that? Does your case stand on us having to say that the statement that the contract's terminated is false, or does your case still stand even if we say we don't agree with you on that point?
I think it will still stand if you don't agree with me on that point, because you have to look at the statement as a whole here. I mean, the statement is, because of your deliberate and flagrant breaches, I'm terminating the agreement. Well, that is false. That is not why he is terminating that agreement. There is sufficient facts in the record to show that he was terminating this agreement to make sure that he controlled who the buyer was. There is facts in the during the trial that Mr. Hansen's daughters attempted to purchase this property. They put in an offer of $110,000, which was $80,000 less than the asking price. They rejected that. Shortly thereafter, a telephone call comes in from one of his daughters saying, the threat, that well agreement is solely between you and my father. Then shortly after that, you get the May 19th, 2006 letter, where all of a sudden he's making up these false claims in order to make the false statement that he is rescinding this agreement. He did not believe that they had actually breached this agreement and that that was the reason why he was terminating this agreement. He made these false statements and filed them solely to make sure that he was the one that controlled who was going to get that property, and he tried to make sure that his daughters received that property at a significantly reduced price.
But the problem that the question I have is that the very question of rescission had to come all the way to the Supreme Court. And I think this follows what Justice Konenkamp. How can you say that was a slant, or how can you say that that can be the basis of a slander of title when it had to actually come to a court and it came all the way to the Supreme Court and there was arguable, valid arguments on both sides on whether, as I recall, there was valid arguments on both sides on, I don't remember the water part, but the electrical part. Can't remember if that was part of the argument, but obviously there were some valid arguments that lawyers argued in front of us. How can then you use? I mean, so you know, maybe he didn't. He hated his neighbors and didn't want anybody else to buy that. Why does that matter if he really legitimately thought, or that there was a legitimate basis for filing that?
And again,
not what his mindset was, but there was a legitimate basis.
You know, and after the trial court, again, spent a day and a half listening to the testimony and weighing the credibility of the witnesses, he determined that he did not believe that he had a legitimate basis for terminating that well agreement. He believed that his reasons that were stated were false. He did not, I believe it's statement of fact number 44, where Judge Eckery states, Hansen knew that his public filing of the notice of rescission operated to tell the world that he, Hansen, had the right to shut off all water and access to ground property. He had no such right, and he knew that. That's what Judge Eckridge found after a day and a half long hearing in weighing the credibility of James Hansen, that he knew that, or should have known, that he could not terminate that well agreement.
But look at the conclusion of law number three. I think the trial court doesn't agree with you on this point, and maybe we're just belaboring it too much, but he's saying that Hansen's legal argument was honestly debatable. That's on page 20 of finding three. So I mean, he's not saying that purely because he said that you can't unilaterally rescind the contract, that in itself is false.
Again, I think what Judge Eckery was saying is that what is false here is him saying that he is terminating this for these reasons, which he knew were not correct and which he knew then would not provide him with a basis for terminating that agreement because they are incorrect reasons.
All right. That's one of the causes of action. There's a second cause of action on tortious interference with a contract. Does that support your claim regardless of the first cause of action?
It would support the damages of perhaps with the exception of the award for attorney's fees. There's been some question of the causation here. Dan Rowe, with the owner of the Mead Tile Company, specifically testified that the filing caused an exception to be placed on Schedule B of the title insurance policy, which would cause a mortgage company, such as the one that the Fords were utilizing to finance the purchase of that property, to be concerned. You then have testimony of Paula Ford, Joe Ford, stating that they got to the title company on July 11th, 2006, at the time for the closing. That's when they learned that this filing had occurred. That's when they learned that their title company, or excuse me, their mortgage company, would not provide them the financing because of that filing, because of Hansen's malicious filing of the May 19th, 2006 letter. That, Judge Eckridge heard that. There is testimony in the record to support his finding. The finding is not clearly erroneous and must be upheld. There is a suggestion in the appellant's brief that a conditional privilege of good faith filing applied. The court, again, in findings of fact number 41, found that his filing was malicious. The testimony at the trial supports his finding of fact. Not only the fact that, you know, regarding the payments of the well, electrical bill, the campers that he knew about always being there for the last 10 years, but also the telephone call between Paula Ford and James Hansen immediately after the closing did not occur on July 11th. Paula Ford called up Mr. Hansen and asked him, is there a way that we can work this out? She described Mr. Hansen during that conversation as being nasty and angry. She further testified that he told her that the Browns had no right to be selling that property. It should have never been for sale because they put in a good offer and it should have been accepted. He was going to make sure the Browns did not sell that property and that the Fords never obtained that property. That clearly supports the finding of malice in this case. Moving to the claims regarding the tortious interference of a business contract. The question in the proposed in the brief seemed to be whether there was a proper or improper purpose for the filing. In St. Ange Livestock Company versus Curtis, the Supreme Court set forth the elements for tortious interference of a business contract, and that third element provided, you know, an intentional and unjustified act of interference. The terminology was merely changed in the Gruelke versus Sioux Empire Federal Credit Union case to say improper instead of unjustified. But the fact remains that the court looked at various facts and circumstances in determining whether there was a proper or improper purpose. And most of the courts look at the facts or the elements or factors as set forth in the Restatement Second of Torts 767. The court made findings addressing all of these that can be found in findings of facts 26 through 31 and also 41 through 47. Thus, the court's finding that James Hansen tortiously interfered with a business contract because the improperly or unjustified act of interfering is supported by the record evidence. And again, that would be a finding of fact, and being supported by the record evidence is not clearly erroneous. Now, there also seemed to be a contention of whether there's a reference to the footnote in the Gruelke case where it stated that at least one court has held that motivation of personal gain, including financial gain, is not an improper purpose. Well, I think if you actually read the Gruelke case, you know, that's an employment context case, and the court stated that, you know, it's now settled law that corporate agents are not liable for tortious interference with a corporation's contract unless they act solely for their own benefit, with no benefit to the corporation. I further say that such individuals should not stand immune from their independently improper acts committed entirely for personal ends. Thus, any suggestion that this was proper because he was doing this for his own personal gain or financial gain is not a basis to keep him from being liable under tortious interference with the business contract claim in South Dakota.
Well, I'd like to move on to something before you run out of time on damages. On the attorney fees element of damages under SDCL 43-30-9, Judge Eckridge gave two different bases for the attorney fees. One was under the statute, the second was as an element of damages for the slander of title. And under the statute, it provides in any action brought for the purpose of acquiring title to land. Now, this was a declaratory judgment action. It wasn't a quiet title action under the quiet title statute. Does that make a difference?
No, I don't believe it does. It was declaratory judgment. It was also a slander of title claim. Basically, to get the court's ruling that the notice of rescission that was filed was of no force in effect, so that they, in effect, had clear and marketable title so that they could convey that property. If you look at SDCL 43-30, what that chapter does is it sets forth a bar, I guess, of any claims, interest, or charges in personal property being brought against a landowner who himself or his successors in interest have an unbroken chain of title for a period of 22 to 23 years and have been in possession. However, the statute or the chapter also allows for a way to avoid that bar from being able to bring one's claim for an interest or claim or charge to the property by filing a notice of a claim. Here, by him filing this notice in the Meade County Clerk of Courts, he is, and as he's argued in his appellant's brief and the reply brief and even here this morning, he's claimed that he has some economic interest in this property that he's attempting to protect. He, in effect, is filing a notice of claim to that economic interest, and as a result, 4030-1 is going to apply because the court found that he did this to slander the title, or found that he did slander the title to the Browns' property. Furthermore, and alternatively, I guess I should say, the court should award attorney's fees as special damages or have them deemed as special damages in this case if it's going to find that SEL 43-30-9 is not going to apply. That's based on the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 633, which provides that, losses for injurious falsehood and slander of title will include expenses of measurable and reasonably necessary expenses to counteract the publication, including litigation to remove the doubt cast upon the vendability or value by disparagement. Attorney's fees included in removing the cloud from the title and restoring vendability are necessary expenses of counteracting the effects of the slander. Adopting Restatement Second of Torts, various sections, to allow for an award of attorney fees is not something new to the state of South Dakota. In Jacobson v. Lessinger, the Supreme Court did that to allow for attorney's fees to be included as an expense in the further litigation in order for a person to obtain back their personal property that was unlawfully converted from them.
As I looked at the billing that was an exhibit, it appeared that the billing that was allowed for attorney fees was up through the first Supreme Court proceeding, and it was not for any of the proceedings after that.
That is correct. It was just solely for the time and effort spent in getting the slander removed from the Browns title, which is what is permitted under the Restatement Second of Torts. And because it was found to be slander title, again, I contend that it is permissible under 43-30-9 as well. If I can go back, in the Jacobson versus Lessinger case, the court actually cited Rovig versus Douglas. And in the Rovig versus Douglas, they also, Washington also adopts the Restatement Second of Torts, allowing for an award of attorney's fees as special damages And the rationale is really quite sound. The rationale is that the defendant, who by intentional and calculated action leaves the plaintiff with only one course of action, which is litigation. The plaintiffs have no other option but to litigate in order to get the removal of the slanderous filing that Hansen put on their property. Furthermore, in slander of title actions, the defendants actually know that their conduct forces the plaintiff to litigate. Actual damages are sometimes difficult to establish and oftentimes are minimal in slander of title actions. Fairness requires a plaintiff to have some recourse against the intentional malicious acts of the defendant. If the court is not going to find that attorney's fees are awarded here or available here under 43-30-9, it needs to adopt the restatement section of the torts because fairness and justice requires it. I had a couple other things I wanted to address, but I appreciate the opportunity to come up here and be in front of you, and hopefully this won't be my last time.
Thank you, Mr. Wilde. Mr. Gordon, you have 10 minutes, sir.
We hope it's the last one on this case.
So do I.
We do, too. Justice Severson, you asked a question about tortious interference and the viability of that claim. The Grohlke case states that the tort of intentional interference with contractual relations is a remedy for contracting parties against interference from outside intermeddlers. The case law we cited on brief from the state of Georgia expresses that in order to be an outside intermeddler, you must be a stranger to both the contract and the underlying business relationship. Well, clearly, Mr. Hansen was not a stranger to the underlying business relationship because that well agreement ran with the land and it was binding on the party's successors and assigns. So he was stuck with what happened with the Browns' buyers as well. So I would urge the court that he's not an outside intermeddler with regard to the claim of tortious interference. As far as attorney's fees, 4339 is part of our ancient titles chapter. That chapter is about closing the door on claims against titles after a certain period of time. And, of course, under longstanding rules of statutory construction, you have to read all statutes in pari materia together. And if you do that, I would urge that 4039 does not stand for the proposition that in this case, as Judge Eckridge ruled, the Browns are entitled to attorney's fees, because that's not what that body of law is about. Moreover, as the court has steadfastly adhered to, the American rule contemplates that unless you have a contract or an explicit and specific statutory basis, you don't get your attorney's fees. And 4039 is not that basis. Now, and I think Mr. Dillon cited one case, but rarely has the court veered from that steadfast adherence to the American rule, stating instead that that's for the legislature to do. Now, 4039, as the court said in Gregory's versus Hahn, alludes to an action at common law for slander of title. Now, alluding to an action for slander of title and stating specifically and explicitly that you're entitled to attorney's fees are two different things. I would urge the court that statute does not contemplate the right to attorney's fees in this realm, and moreover, attorney's fees were not, if you will review the pleadings, pled as special damages as required for slander of title in this case. They weren't in the plaintiff's complaint, and they weren't in the plaintiff's amended complaint either, nor were the $6,300 credit given in the court's damage calculation, which if you recall Mr. Hansen's brief, was the credit based upon what the Fords might have as an action against the Browns. not could or would or what was allowable as against Mr. Hansen, but what they might have. Now, as we argued on brief, if you remove that $6,300, which wasn't pled specially and I would suggest wasn't demonstrated as actual damages as against Mr. Hansen, then the Browns had no damages and therefore no right to punitive damages. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Court will be in recess.